Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. This is episode 97 of Law for Virginia Law Enforcement Officers. What do you need to know as a law enforcement officer in the Commonwealth of Virginia to better strengthen and serve your communities? And today, we're going to continue talking about ECO, Emergency Custody Order, and TDO law in the Commonwealth of Virginia. In the last episode, if you got a chance to tune in, we were talking about use of force. And in the episode before that, we were talking about ECO and TDO basics, just the fundamentals of the law in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So today, what I want to do is continue that conversation about use of force when it comes to ECOs and TDOs. If you don't do a lot of ECOs and TDOs, I still think today's episode will be useful for you, because really what you're going to see is that this is a basic question about law enforcement use of force and how courts judge use of force in 2023, whether it's for an ECO or any other purpose. So we'll have a good chance to talk about use of force generally in this episode. As we start, though, I want to just do a quick review. Two episodes ago, in episode 95, we really emphasized what was the standard, especially for an ECO. I mean, a TDO, you're almost always doing a TDO for, you have a court order, so it's going to be pretty straightforward. But a lot of ECOs, emergency custody orders, are done paperless. And so what do you need to do a paperless ECO? Well, 37.2808 tells us that you need probable cause of three things. Number one, that a person has a mental illness and that there exists a substantial likelihood that as a result of that mental illness, the person will, in the near future, cause serious physical harm to themselves or somebody else, as evidenced by recent behavior, causing, attempting, or threatening harm or some other relevant information, if any, right? Or that there is a substantial likelihood that as a result of mental illness, the person will in the near future suffer serious harm due to his lack of capacity to protect himself from harm or provide for his basic human needs. So that's the first thing, right? Second of all, there needs to be probable cause the individual is in need of hospitalization or treatment. And then thirdly, that there's probable cause that the person is unwilling to volunteer or incapable of volunteering for hospitalization or treatment. And with those three elements in mind, then you have the authority to take that person into custody under an emergency custody order. And remember, when we're talking about probable cause, I always emphasize this. Probable cause doesn't mean more likely than not. It means a fair probability, right? So Gerstein versus Pugh is a Supreme Court case, classic on this. Probable cause does not require, in the Supreme Court, I'm quoting here, does not require the fine resolution of conflicting evidence that a reasonable doubt standard or even a preponderance of the evidence standard demands, right? Preponderance of the evidence is 51% or 50.1%. And we don't require that for probable cause. Probable cause is a fair probability. But in judging whether or not we have probable cause to do an ECO or a TDO, we have to recognize, and also when judging how much force we can use, we have to recognize that the law about this is limited. And I think we talked about this two episodes ago, but the Fourth Circuit pointed this out in a case called Gooden versus Howard County. And here's their quote: "The lack of clarity in the law governing seizures for psychological evaluations is striking when compared to the standards detailed in other Fourth Amendment contexts, where probable cause to suspect criminal misconduct has been painstakingly defined." So yeah, it's we have a lot of law about ECO and TDOs, about Fourth Circuit issues, searches and seizures and so on, but we don't have a lot of law about ECOs and TDOs. We do have one recent case I do want to talk about from 2020 that talks about probable cause for an ECO, and that's a case called Barrett versus PAE. And it's an interesting case where it's a case where the plaintiff believes she was being stalked and harassed by Southeast Asian men who were reporting back to a Dubai-based network on their cell phones. She had allegedly had taken steps to identify her stalkers and their locations in the U.S. She believed that one of her stalkers had, quote, successfully breached her office, and then another was watching her outside of her office, and she took various measures to attempt to expose or stop her stalkers. But she complained that nobody believed her. And so the employer, and again, 10 to 15% of their employees could fit the description of the people that she thought was trying to, hunt her down and kill her. They called the police, and the police showed up and said, you know, hey, what's going on? Can you tell me what's happening here? She explains that she owned a firearm. She had taken a firearms course to obtain her concealed carry permit, and she hoped that she would have the courage to defend herself from these people lurking and hiding and spying on her if necessary. She explained that there was no legal means to deal with her stalkers. And then, so although she didn't make a direct threat to kill her stalkers, she did make several references to killing, quote, uncivilized Middle Eastern men, and she hoped she'd be able to defend herself if necessary. So police sought an ECO order, and good for them for going to get the order, right, rather than making the decision on their own. They sought an order, they obtained an order, and the Virginia Department of Health Services determined that there was probable cause to believe that the plaintiff was suffering from PTSD and possibly a delusional disorder, and that she was a danger to herself and others, and the magistrate issued ultimately issued an ECO and then a TDO for her. When she was released, she sued, and the court reviewed the evidence here and said, you know, the evidence established that the police had probable cause to detain her, that there was certainly qualified immunity barred the claim, and summary judgment was awarded. And also rejected the claim for false imprisonment because the officers in the eyes of the court had probable cause to believe that she posed a threat to herself and others and lawfully detained her for an emergency health evaluation. Now, the court found here a decision had to be made, and the officers made the reasonable, albeit difficult, judgment that the plaintiff posed a danger to herself and others and should be transported to the hospital for a mental health evaluation. And the court here wrote, officers should not be faulted for taking action against what they perceive to be a genuine danger to the plaintiff and others at that time. So what I really want to do, though, is come back and talk about use of force, right? That's really what I want to focus on here today. We talked about last time the Graham versus Conner standard and how courts apply that, especially in 1983 cases, if we're having a lawsuit under 42 U.S.C. 1983, right? The standard is going to be pretty clear. We talked about it last time. In Virginia, right, we have lawsuits for battery, but again, the Virginia Code has been amended to provide that, again, we're applying the Graham versus Conner standard. So how would we apply this in a real case? Well, fortunately, there's actually a case that's pending right now, and it's a case from the Fourth Circuit, and it's a case called Lawhon versus Edwards. Now, this is a case which the Fourth Circuit ruled on just back in November of 2021. But we're going to look at the original district court opinion because it's a little bit more detailed and gives us a little more information. A couple of things that I think are really interesting about this case to start with is the decision to pursue an ECO in the first place. The case starts with Mr. Lawhon, who's a 32-year-old man who has a history of paranoid schizophrenia. And he fell, ended up with a bloody nose, and needed to be restrained and taken to the hospital. And his roommate called the police and asked for help. Police responded, and they asked, you know, what happened, what's going on? And Lawhon himself tells the police, I took some drugs that I shouldn't have that sent me to the pit of hell. Lawhon tells the police that he fell on the floor on purpose after having taken a lot of Wellbutrin. And his mental state is he's very agitated, he's yelling, he could not answer basic questions, he could not even give his own name to the EMS workers. But he did refuse medical care and demanded that the EMS and the police officers leave his apartment. However, his roommate insisted that the EMS take Mr. Lawhon, that he's in no state to be left alone. He's a danger to himself. Please take him. The officer then told Lawhon that he was going to remove him from the premises under a ECO, here a medical ECO. And took him into custody. And the court reviews that decision and says, all right, well, did they have probable cause to do a paperless ECO? Well, yes, the court says. First, we go through those factors, right? Number one, did he have a mental illness? Yeah. And was there a substantial likelihood that as a result of his illness, that he would in the near future cause serious physical harm to himself or others? Well, yeah, they show up, he's covered in blood, he's speaking incoherently, he tells law enforcement and EMS that the injuries are self-induced. He said he'd been falling down on purpose, he'd taken a lot of Wellbutrin, and the roommate clearly and resolutely says, you can't leave, he's a danger to himself and to other people. He's clearly in need of hospitalization or treatment, all right? And so we got our second factor there. And then third factor, he's clearly unwilling to voluntarily receive hospital treatment. So here, if you review the factors that we talked about for a paperless ECO, Lawhon qualifies for a paperless ECO, right? No question about it. But now we get to that question, right, of how much force is appropriate. And Graham versus Connor tells us, and the Virginia Code now tells us as well, that we weigh three things: the severity of the crime at issue, whether the person poses an immediate threat of safety to the officer or others, and whether they're actively resisting arrest or attempting to evade by arrest by flight. It being an ECO, we're not going to get any severity of crime, at least not at this point, but there's certainly a threat here, the threat to himself, certainly. And then we're going to see some active resistance or evasion by flight. So let's talk about what happens after the officer says, all right, I'm going to take you into custody and do an ECO. The officer grabs Lawhon and throws him to the ground. He forces him into the prone position. And Lawhon, because of where he is, he ends up face down on a pillow. Officers are able to get Lawhon handcuffed in about 30 seconds, but they leave him on the pillow face down. And Lawhon starts yelling, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, while officers and EMS workers are on his back. And he continues to struggle. He spits on a police officer. And so the first question, right, is, can I grab somebody and throw them on the ground, put them in a prone position face down to take them into custody? And the courts here say, yeah, that's something that we do a lot in law enforcement. It happens to be one of the safest ways, unfortunately, that there is to take somebody in custody. And simply putting somebody in a prone position isn't deadly force. It isn't excessive force here. Putting just enough weight to immobilize an individual who is continuing to struggle during handcuffing is not excessive force. And here the court notes that the officers attempted to de-escalate the situation. They counseled Lawhon. They talked to him for about 20 minutes. They extensively tried to get him to go to the hospital voluntarily, keep reassuring him, we're not here to hurt you, we're not here to arrest you, we just want you to get some help. They're not using weapons, anything like that. And then finally, when they make the decision, all right, I'm going to take you into custody, you got to go. Again, they don't employ any weapons, they do minimal pressure. And while they have him on the ground, he's still struggling with them. He's spinning on them. He's actively resisting, right? And that's a Graham versus Connor factor. The fact that somebody is actively resisting, right, is a factor for how much force you can use. And he's certainly actively resisting while he is a threat to himself, right? So initially, right, that force, throwing him on the ground, holding him down while they put handcuffs on him, the court has no problem with that. Well, here's the issue. They continue to hold Lawhon face down on that pillow for about 5 minutes, and then he becomes unresponsive, and ultimately he dies at the hospital due to a irreversible hypoxic brain injury due to cardiac arrest and or asphyxia. And I think it's important here, we don't know, did he get hypoxic brain injury because of cardiac arrest? Because remember, he himself said that he'd overdosed on a lot of drugs. So he's definitely in an overdose state, according to his own statements. But he has cardiac arrest. It also can be asphyxia. So a lot of questions here in this case about that. And this becomes the issue for the court. The court here, the defendants, the officers say, well, you should dismiss this case at this point because our use of force is lawful. And the court says, well, the initial use of force is lawful. But at this stage, the court writes, the court cannot determine whether the defendant's continued use of force, which is to say holding Mr. Lawhon down in the prone position for over 5 minutes, holding him in the prone position after he's saying, I can't breathe, is justified. And so the court here says the officer is constantly, obviously it's important, and in fact this case it's true that the officers constantly were monitoring Lawhon while they had him in the prone position, asking him, are you okay? Asking him, are you able to breathe? They're talking to him, they're communicating with him. And again, there's a lot of issue in this case about why he died, which might be drug-related. But the court finds it's not enough evidence to just dismiss the case outright. The court writes, at this stage, the record remains inadequate to determine whether the totality of force used over several minutes was reasonable and proportionate. So that's the ruling of the district court in 2020, the trial court, and it goes to the Fourth Circuit in 2021. The Fourth Circuit hears arguments in the case, and ultimately they agree that the case cannot be dismissed at this point, that, you know, it's an issue basically for the jury at this point. And the, you know, the court here examines the facts that we talked about and says, you know, a plaintiff in this case could make out a claim of excessive force in this case, right? He's committed no crime. He's outnumbered. He's handcuffed. Once he's prone on the ground, once he's in handcuffs, once he's in custody, how is he still a threat? That's got to be articulated. And, you know, the severity of the injuries compared to the severity of the crime at issue, whether he's posing an immediate threat while handcuffed, whether he's actively resisting, the amount of force used here is, you know, he ends up dying, right? So the court here says that a jury could find that that's excessive force if that's ultimately what causes his death. And that's got to be a jury question because that's a question in this case. But the court here finds that because the officers don't cease the use of force after he's motionless, unresponsive, it's up to the jury here to decide whether or not the force was excessive or not. So this is a ruling from the Fourth Circuit. Again, it's pretrial. They remand the case back to the trial court for trial. And it looks like in 2022, and again, this it's not public, so we don't know, but the last news story about this case is that the case was ultimately settled before trial, so we won't ever get a jury verdict, and we won't ever get a hearing, a final ruling on this. So the other case I want to talk about today is a case called Pittman versus Harris. And I think Putnam versus Harris, which is a 2023 case of an individual who is suicidal. And this is, I think, also a really interesting case. This is a case where the plaintiff sent several texts to his wife threatening self-harm and suicide. And one of his messages said he had a gun in his mouth and said, "Don't come to the house, I'd rather somebody else find me." So the wife calls 911, and when the police arrived, she shared texts. The text that she'd been getting, she also told police that the plaintiff regularly drank alcohol and that he owned several firearms. She couldn't say whether he had a gun with him, but obviously he says he has a gun in his mouth and says, "Don't come here." So the police ask her, "Can we go onto your property to go looking for him?" And she says, "Yes, you can search the property." The officers search the house. They don't find the plaintiff. They don't find the husband, but they do find a rifle in the house. The property is surrounded by woods, so they call in a canine unit, a canine officer. And when they find the plaintiff finally, they don't see any firearms, but they do see that he is intoxicated. So they order him to stand up and they order him to lift his hands. He refuses. He says, "This is my property and I'm not getting up and I'm not lifting my hands. I'm on my property. I didn't do anything wrong. Basically, get out of here." The officers say, "No, we're not leaving. Put up your hands. He starts aggressively yelling at the officers. He's flailing his arms around. He refuses to turn around. And he won't show the back of his waistband. And they're demanding, "Hey, turn around, show me your waistband. And he won't do that. They say, "If you do not comply, you're going to get bit by the dog, by our dog. And he says, Show me a warrant in your hand to be on my property. The officers say, "We don't need a warrant to be here." Again, turn around, and he says, "Why? What have I done wrong? I haven't committed any crime, right?" And, you know, again, this is a common issue with the Graham versus Connor standard in these cases for use of force. There isn't a crime, usually, in most ECO cases, and there's no crime here. So the officers say, "Didn't you say that you're going to kill yourself?" And he says, "No, I didn't say that." He said, "Where's the gun? Show me the effing gun." And at that point, he lifts his shirt up to say, "Look, see, I have no gun. I've got no gun. Show me the gun. I obviously have no gun." But he still won't turn around. And so the officers still can't see his back. And so he's only shown the front of his waistband. So at this point, the officers make a decision that they're going to release the dog. The plaintiff refuses to turn around. He says no. And again, he lifts his shirt, but he only shows the front. And they say, look, if you don't comply, you're going to get bit by the dog. And he says, why? Why am I going to get bit by the dog? I haven't done anything. Well, at that point, the officers release the dog. The dog bites the plaintiff, and then the officers subdue him, and the dog obviously releases them. And at that point, the plaintiff sues the officers. The district court here, the trial court, rules that the lawsuit should proceed because the plaintiff didn't pose an immediate threat to the officers. And so the case goes to the Fourth Circuit, and that's this year here in 2023. And the Fourth Circuit rules in this case here that the officers made the fair call that the plaintiff posed a danger to himself and therefore were not required to walk away from the situation merely because he denied that he was suicidal, right? The standard here is probable cause. Probable cause doesn't mean more likely than not. But the court concluded it was that a reasonable officer could have believed that the plaintiff was armed and therefore posed an immediate threat. And since this immediate safety risk was reasonably likely to be cured by using the dog, the deployment of the dog was justified. And so the court rules that the district court should have dismissed the lawsuit. The court here says that although the officers could not see a firearm and the plaintiff denied having a firearm, the officers couldn't confirm it because he refused to turn around and show his entire waistband. And, you know, obviously, in the court here, and this is the Fourth Circuit, which we talked about in August, had ruled that, you know, officers unlawfully shot someone who was holding a gun or refusing to drop it, who had said he was going to, you know, use the gun. The court here says just because a person is armed doesn't give officers carte blanche to use any force, right? And that goes to our discussion about the case from August where the officers shoot the guy with a gun in his hand. But here, the court says the plaintiff wasn't complying with commands and the officer fairly believed he was armed, right? He said he had a gun. The wife knew him to have guns. He said he was going to kill himself. He said, don't come here, etc. And so the court explained that as long as there are facts from which an officer can reasonably conclude that the resistance presents some immediate danger despite its nonviolent character, the force used by the officers in this case was warranted. And so here, right, we have a pretty clear statement in favor of a use of non-deadly force. And I think it's important here that it's non-deadly force, but non-deadly force against an individual who is suicidal. The last case I want to talk about is a case that I think we all kind of know, right? And it's a case that's very familiar to you, and you probably know the case. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I think it's still important that we review it because it's an ECO case, right? And that's the case of Armstrong versus Pinehurst. This is a 2016 case from the Fourth Circuit. And you know this case because this is the Taser case, right? Remember the Taser case from 2016? But let's look at it from an ECO context, right? What happens in this case? A doctor issues an ECO against the plaintiff in this case, Mr. Armstrong, who was bipolar and schizophrenic after he'd been poking holes in his skin and he been trying to hurt himself, and he flees the emergency room, AMA. And the doctor noticed in the order, the plaintiff is a danger to himself. Now, it's important here to note that in North Carolina, when the doctor fills out his form, he can say danger to himself, danger to others, or both. And in here, the doctor just says, Mr. Armstrong's only a danger to himself. He's not a danger to others. You're never going to run into that in Virginia because we don't have that option, right? We only have the option on the form of danger to self or others. But here, Armstrong is a clear indication Armstrong's a danger to himself and only a danger to himself. And when they find him, he's still walking away from the hospital and he's cooperative. He's talking to the officers. I mean, he's obviously not right. He's eating grass. He's eating gauze. He's putting cigarettes out on his tongue. There's something wrong with Mr. Armstrong. He wanders into traffic a couple times because he's standing right near the roadway. And the officers are like, hey, man, you know, be safe. Come on over here. Talk to us. But he's compliant. He's calm until the involuntary commitment order shows up. And when it shows up, Mr. Armstrong says, I'm not going, and wraps himself around a metal post and says he's not going to move. And so after the officers kind of pull and tug on his arms for about 30 seconds, they say, if you don't let go, we're going to tase you. And so he doesn't let go. And so over the course of a 2-minute period, the officers drive stun Mr. Armstrong 5 times. Now, if you're familiar with drive stun taser and you've been drive stun tased before, you know what happens to your body at that point, right? It clenches up, it locks up. So it's not causing him to let go of the post, right? What we have here is a classic pain compliance tool. And it's not working, right? He's not letting go. And so finally, 2 hospital security officers show up. Someone else shows up. And finally, with, 5 people on scene, they're able to physically pull him off of the post. He keeps fighting. He keeps struggling. He's kicking at the officers while they handcuff him. They finally get him in handcuffs. They get him fat on the ground. And then within 5 minutes, he's dead. It's not really clear what causes him to die. He's just sort of laying there and then he just dies. The questions about how he dies aside, he sues the law enforcement officers under the 4th Amendment, and he says the officers use excessive force. The district court dismissed the case on qualified immunity grounds, finding that the force was excessive, was objectively reasonable, and the case goes to the 4th Circuit. Right. So here, there's no question we have the lawful authority to take him into custody for an ECO because we have that ECO from the doctor. Right. So under North Carolina law, that doctor's ECO gives them the legal authority to take him into custody. Question then becomes how much force is reasonable. And we're going to apply Graham versus Connor. Right. Factor number 1, severity of the crime at issue. There's no crime. Right. And again, you don't need to have a crime to use force. You can use force in a TDO or ECO situation. But here, there's no crime. What about, is he a threat to himself or others? Yes, he's a threat to himself. But we're going to look at the force that's used at the moment that he's sitting on the ground holding onto the post. And at that point, what threat is he to himself or anybody else? Well, he's surrounded by people, 5 people, two people, I guess, at the time that he's drive stun tased. He's simply refusing to move. And he's refusing to move, right, because our 3rd factor is he's actively resisting or evading arrest. His refusal had lasted 30 seconds. And so here the court quotes a U.S. Supreme Court case, Addington versus Texas. The state has a legitimate interest in providing care to its citizens who are unable, because of emotional disorders, to care for themselves. The state also has authority under its police power to protect the community from dangerous tendencies of some who are mentally ill. However, the state has no interest in confining individuals involuntarily if they're not mentally ill or if they don't pose some danger to themselves or others. And so here the court says, and the court writes, where during the course of seizing an outnumbered mentally ill individual who's a danger only to himself, police officers choose to deploy a taser in the face of a stationary and nonviolent resistance to being handcuffed, those officers use unreasonably excessive force. While qualified immunity shields the officers in this case from liability, and we'll talk about that in a second, law enforcement officers should now be on notice that such taser use violates the 4th Amendment. Because in this case, the court rules that these officers were not on notice, that we hadn't made clear, the law hadn't made clear, that a taser use is a high-level use of force. But there's a case, Smith versus Town of South Hill, that comes out in 2020, where officers, and this is a district court case, so we don't have a ruling yet, but the court says in this case that officers who used a taser against an individual for whom they had an ECO in the town of South Hill, and who is inside of a car and kicking and punching inside the car, and aggressive and combative. Here, the court says that officers used a taser without any attempt to de-escalate the situation, and although the officers could have used some force to take Mr. Jones into custody, painful, injurious, serious inflictions of force like the use of a taser do not become reasonable simply because officers have authorization to arrest a subject who is unrestrained. So what you see, I think, is after Armstrong, that courts are treating taser usage as a very high-level use of force, whereas, I think, frankly, back in the early 2000s and mid-2000s, we looked at a taser use as a very low-level use of force. And the court recognized that in Armstrong, which is why they dismissed the case for qualified immunity, was that there was this training and this concept at the time that tasers were, you know, the least intrusive or the least high, you know, the lowest level of force that you could use. Now it's treated very much differently after Armstrong and the South Hill case, the Smith versus South Hill case, I think, really emphasizes that. The court finds that the taser usage against Mr. Jones in his car, and again, he also dies after his arrest, is a very high-level use of force. So I hope today was an interesting or helpful view of how courts view ECOs and TDO use of force. Again, we'll keep talking about this topic. I think it's an interesting topic in the future. Like I said, stay tuned for episode 100. We got, a really interesting episode for that. Hopefully I'm going to have for you. And so stay tuned for that. But for today, that's all from me. That's all from Big E. Stay safe and don't get captured.